set up the Yeshiva High School system.
The way that we used to learn, and I had the privilege of meeting someone years ago, the father of a close friend who had learned with the Chofetz Chaim when he was a kid in Radney. And I once got to talking to him, and I was asking him, you know, I obviously peppered him for stories about the Chofetz Chaim and Radney, but every time he would come to the community, to the west side where I grew up, I would ask him different questions. And one time we got to talking about what it was like before he went to Radney, in Cheder. And so I asked him, what was that like? What was it like to sit in Cheder, right? To learn Talmud Torah. He didn't really understand the question. I said, well, you know, did you have tests? Did you have attendance? Was there homework? He still didn't understand the question. He said, listen, there were 14 of us. We didn't need attendance. If a chair was empty, the Rebbe knew it was empty, and you would get a klop the next day, right? There were no tests because he would constantly review what we learned, and, you know, you would do chazara. And he would sometimes put out treats if he wanted you to get more excited, and that was it. It was a very simple system, and you learned all day. There was nothing to compete with. So I asked him, what kept kids going to Cheder when you were 9, 10 years old? So it was very simple. If we didn't stay in Cheder, we knew we'd have to go and work. Right? His dad was a tailor. The last thing in the world he wanted to do was sit in a tailor shop all morning from morning until night. So he stayed in Cheder. Now we've created a system, and I'm not indicting it, but we've created a system where we want our kids to get into colleges, and therefore they have to study secular studies. And secular studies is good. I'm not at all suggesting that we should stop students from studying secular studies. But because of that, we've divided our day into half. By nature, secular studies demand tests and projects and homework and papers and whatnot. In order for Jewish studies to compete with those secular studies, they inevitably have to offer the same rigorous challenge. And therefore, we've turned learning into a half-day at best affair with tests and papers, homework, grades. So to some degree, we've set up the system. When kids come to Israel, we have a yeshiva called Oraita in the old city of Yerushalayim. It's a post-high school gap year program. Somebody sitting here who went there, you can ask him about it afterwards. And boys come and they have no tests, and they have no homework, and they have no papers, and they get to study all day. And if the yeshivas run right, they're actually learning what it is they want to be learning, and that's a system in and of itself. So by definition, that has to be a better way for Jewish kids to connect with Jewish learning. And the challenge to the Jewish community is whether there's a way to affect that earlier. Right? So that's first of all. And there are a lot of ideas, and if anybody's interested, I'm going to put this out because I am going to run when we're done. But if anybody's interested afterwards, you can take this with pleasure, and you can shoot me an email. I'll be more than happy to suggest different ideas. That's the first caveat. Second caveat is we're going to talk a little bit about Moshe Rabbeinu's children. I remember years ago studying with Nechama Leibovich, and she would often make the point, and if you read the Sichot of Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl, he makes the same point. On the one hand, we have to take apart the stories of our forefathers, foremothers. We have to imagine that we're viewing Moshe Rabbeinu as a leader, as a teacher, with all of his failings. And yet, at the same time, let's remember, we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. So I don't want anybody here to assume that I feel sort of, you know, able to critique Moshe Rabbeinu. And yet, that's what Chazal do, and there is something to learn from that. What happened to Moshe Rabbeinu's children? There is a very strange story in Shoftim, right, in the book of Judges, Perek Yudzayin, Perek Yudchet. There's a priest of sorts called Michiyahu, and he basically starts a cult of idolatry. And he's looking for a charismatic, dynamic leader who can sort of take the reins of his new business, which is effectively what it is. And he finds a fellow called Yonatan, right? If you look in Perek Yudchet, Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Right? Now the word Menashe, this is later in the story, is spelled in a very strange fashion. The Nun sort of floats above the letters Mem Shin He. And so the rabbis, the Gemara and Bava Batra, suggest that we're actually talking about Yonatan, who was the son of Gershom, who was the son of Moshe Rabbeinu. And they ascribe him to Menashe because Menashe was the son of Chizkiyahu Melech. Now it can't be that he was the son of Menashe, because Menashe lived many hundreds of years later. Rather, because Menashe led the people astray to idolatry, so this fellow was ascribed to idolatry as well. And because they didn't want it so blatant in the verses that this was a grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu, that's why there's this strange textual anomaly. The grandson of Moshe Rabbeinu is an idolatrous priest. Now he will at the end of the story, through the vestige of David HaMelech, sort of do tshuva. He becomes renamed Shuvael. He becomes an accountant. I'm not going to talk about what that means. But how did that happen? What happened to the children of Moshe Rabbeinu? And is there a lesson that we can learn regarding the challenges that we have with our children? You know, if you could pick how we want a student to walk out the doors of our Jewish educational systems, if you could pick an adjective that you would hope when you invest, you know, there are different opinions as to how much money is invested in every student. The rolling number is about $500,000. When you consider high school tuition, yeshiva high school tuition, yeshiva day school tuition, summer camps, the percentage of tuition that is actually funded by donors, because no tuition ever covers the actual cost of what it costs to put a kid through Jewish education, $500,000. So if you're looking at this child, and he's 4 years old, and you're recognizing that as a community we're going to spend $500,000 on this child, what do we hope that this child will walk out the doors of yeshiva day school and yeshiva high school experiencing? If you could pick an adjective, what would it be? Jewishly.
Eagerly committed.
Inspired. In love. That's what you hope for. Now, I don't want to frighten anybody here, and like I said, I'm not indicting the yeshiva high school system, but that does not seem to be the norm. Most kids who finish yeshiva high school at best are committed. Not that many are eagerly committed. Many are excited to go to Israel, not all for the same reasons. If you ask me whether a boy or a girl, and I can only speak for the boys, finishes yeshiva high school inspired, not so sure that that's true. Something's wrong. What are we missing? And one could make a case that Aaron seems to have gotten it right, because his sons become the Kohanim, and eventually one of them Kohen Gadol. Pinchas, his grandson, and Moshe's sons basically disappear. Right? Now, when you take a look at the journey of Moshe Rabbeinu's sons, it's very interesting. We first encounter them at the beginning of Sefer Shemot in Perek Bet. Moshe arrives in Midian. He's run away from Paro and from Mitzrayim. Vayoel Moshe Lashevet Ta'ish. Right, he comes to Yitro's home. The daughters have already said, Vatomarna Ish Mitzri Tzilanu Miyadaruim. There was an Egyptian man. Is he hiding as an Egyptian? Is he more Egyptian than Jewish? Is that part of the problem? Right, this is in Perek Bet Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayoel Moshe Lashevet Ta'ish. Vayitena Tzipora Bitol Moshe. Vayoel means he pushes them. They make some sort of a deal. Vatelet ben, vayikrat shmo Gershom. Ki amar ger hayiti be'eretz nochriya. He names his son Gershom. What does he name his second son? Pardon? We don't know. Because in this story, it doesn't appear. We don't find Eliezer here. Very strange. Now the Medrash, it's an unbelievable Medrash. The Medrash in the Tanchuma suggests the following. Moshe says to Yitro, his future father-in-law, I want to marry your daughter. Amalo, so Yitro says, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. Kabel alecha davar echad, sheni omer lecha, v'ani natal lecha l'isha. I have one condition. And if you accept this condition, she's yours. Amalo Moshe Maus, he says, well, what's the condition? Amalo haben sheye lecha tchila, the first boy that you have, he'll go to idolatry. And after that, you can raise him any way you want, Jewish. So now you're Moshe Rabbeinu, right? You meet this beautiful girl. But her father either is or was, I don't know, a Baptist minister. But you're nuts about this girl. And supposedly she's ready to do giur, she's studying in a seminary, I don't know. So you say, I want your daughter's hand in marriage. Put aside whether you should ask your father-in-law for your daughter's hand. That's an interesting question. I remember when I got married, we were in Israel. And we got engaged, and I felt bad that my in-laws were in America. Right? I had met them, but they weren't there. So I called up my in-laws, and I asked to speak to my father, my future father-in-law. I was a little nervous, and I thought I would do the right thing. So I asked him, I wanted to ask you for your daughter's hand in marriage. There was a pause on the other end of the line in Pittsburgh, and he said, the hand. Why take the hand? Take the whole thing, right? And I knew I was in, right? But people don't do this anymore, but okay. So what should Moshe Rabbeinu say? Are you kidding me? I'm not raising my children as Baptists. But that's not what he says, according to the Midrash. V'kibel alav. V'feresh niyal kachimoni. He accepted, and the Gemara quotes this. This is unbelievable. never mind why Yitro would make such a deal, especially since it seems to be that Yitro has left aside his idolatrous ways, that the shepherds have chased away the daughters, according to Rashi, because Nidu, because they excommunicate him, because he's no longer a Midianite prince. What's going on? So, different Mepharshim talk about this. Chaim Shmuel Levitz in his Sichot Musar has a phenomenal idea. And he says, what we're talking about here is two different educational approaches. Yitro discovered monotheism, discovered God on his own. Nobody force-fed it to him. He didn't get to go to yeshiva day school. He didn't get to go to yeshiva high school. And he felt that that was the best way to develop your relationship as a theist, to discover God on your own. So Yitro says, I don't want you to raise him with all the miracles around him, because then he'll be doing something for the rest of life he's never discovered on his own. And maybe in the future, one day he'll wake up and say, why am I doing all this? Sound familiar? Let him struggle and earn it on his own. Moshe Rabbeinu wants to raise him L'shem Shamayim. Truth is truth. Why on earth would I invite a person to an idolatrous environment when I know that Hashem runs the world? He should be brought up as a Jew. And so Chazal talk about the fact that Moshe agrees, believing that he'll convince Yitro, or he agrees because he believes that he'll be able to convince Yitro down the road, or whatever it might be. And even though Gershom in fact does grow up to be a Jewish lad, as we'll see in a minute, nonetheless, something Bashamayim remains from this deal. And Gershom's descendant, his son, according to Mepharshim, becomes an idolater. What are those two different approaches? What is it that Moshe seems to be doing wrong according to the Midrash? Then it gets more interesting, because if you keep reading, right, we still haven't met the boys to some degree. But Vayelech Moshe Vayashal Yeter Chitno, after the whole dialogue at the burning bush, Hashem says, Lech Shuv Mitzrayim, Moshe agrees, and then nonetheless Moshe goes back to talk to Yitro, which is a whole discussion in and of its own. Moshe made a deal with Yitro, whatever the door story is there. And then it says, Vayikach Moshe et ishto ve'et banav. He takes his wife and he takes his sons, their sons, his sons, et banav, and they head down to Egypt. And then they have this very strange story on the road, Vatikach Tzipora, right? Eliezer was never circumcised, right? Why wasn't he circumcised? How will he be circumcised? When will he be circumcised? Strange story. Then they get down to Mitzrayim. Sorry. I'll tell you about that because I didn't photo set. They get down to Mitzrayim, and Aaron basically says, Miela, who are these boys? Who is this? What are you bringing here? And Rashi quotes a famous medrash. Well, it's famous because I know it. Rashi quotes the medrash that says that, you know, we're all suffering here. You're bringing more to suffer? And at that point, Tzipora ve'et baneha, and her boys leave. And Moshe continues. And you don't hear anything more about these boys. They disappear off the stage until Perek Yudchet, right before Har Sinai, when Yitro returns. And when Yitro returns, Vayikach Yitro Choten Moshe et Tzipora Eshet Moshe Achar Shiluchea, the Torah reminds us that Tzipora was sent away. Now Yitro brings her back, Vet Shnei Vaneha. And along with her are her two sons. What's the obvious question? They're not just her sons. They're his sons. But they're not really his sons. Because what's the definition of a son? The definition of a son is that there's a relationship. There is no relationship. You wonder if that's what the Torah is suggesting, but okay. Asher shema echad Gershom, ki amar ger hayiti be'eretz nochriya, v'shema echad Eliezer. Fascinating, the Torah differentiates between these two boys. This may be part of the source that allows us this medrash. It should say shema echad Gershom, v'shema sheni Eliezer, but it doesn't say. Each one is an echad. They're different. Maybe they've been brought up differently. Maybe they've pursued different paths. Vayomer el Moshe, ani chotenecha Yitro ba elecha v'ishtecha u'shnei vaneha ima. They're still called shnei vaneha. They're hers. They're not his. There's something wrong. The next time we meet one of the boys, you don't hear about Eliezer, that's it. Right? It would seem that Eliezer, the only other place, by the way, except for something I'm about to quote, is all the way in Divrei Yamin. Divrei Yamim, the Chronicles, is one of the more obscure sections of Tanakh, probably because it's towards the end and we don't get there in Yeshiva High School. But there's a listing, and it basically chronicles. There's seven or eight prakim all about the different delineations of tasks and roles in the basic Mikdash. And in that process, there's a whole description of the genealogy of the tribe of Levi. It's very clear there that the children of Moshe are just rank and file. They become accountants, treasurers. They're basically Levites. There's nothing special about the children of Moshe Rabbeinu. Mind-boggling. The individual to whom no one can compare. It would be hard to imagine an individual who had more of an impact, never mind on Judaism, on the world, who changed destiny, completely changed history, took an entire people out of Egypt, was the vehicle for the downfall of the mightiest empire on the face of the earth, talks to God face to face. If you could imagine a better breeding ground for leadership, spirituality, it'd be hard to find. And his children just disappeared. Now, you could look at the positive side of this, and you could suggest, it's great that in Judaism, nepotism isn't what matters. Right? That was part of what we discussed when we read Parashat Korach. Even if you're the children of Moshe Rabbeinu, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that you'll have a leadership role. But still leaves us with the question. There is one interesting note in Bamidbar a few weeks ago that we read concerning the story of Eldad and Medad. Right? The Jewish people complain to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Actually, they complain to Moshe Rabbeinu. They don't have enough food. Moshe pretty much loses it. Hashem comes to Moshe and says, Asfal lecha shivim ish, gather 70 elders. It's a little strange how that's the reaction to the complaints of the Jewish people. But, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu does that. There's a lottery. They pick six names from each of the 12 tribes, which of course gives us 72 names. As a result, there are two extra. And so Eldad and Medad, who fell in the lot, they stay in the machaneh, they stay in the camp. Now, even though the other 70 are, and by the way, if you want to read a phenomenal article on this by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, discussing the difference between power and influence in that story, it's a phenomenal story, it's a phenomenal discussion, but Eldad and Medad are in the camp. They start the prophecy in the camp. So the Pasuk says in Baalotcha, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Chav Zayin, Vayaratz Hanar, Vayaged LeMoshe. Right? And the lad comes running and tells Moshe Rabbeinu. Vayomer Eldad u'Medad mitnabim b'machaneh. Eldad u'Medad are prophesying in the camp. Now think about this for a minute. He doesn't just walk. He doesn't just pass on the information. He runs. Now if somebody's running to tell the leader of the Jewish people something, what do you assume is going on? There's a crisis. Something's wrong. So what's wrong? There's a usurping of leadership going on. There's some challenge to Moshe's power. Sort of Sacks suggests that there are two models for leadership. There's a model of power, right? When one person, Moshe is the king, Vayhi v'shurun melech. And a king, one of the fundamental sort of existential realities of a king is that he holds power. And when you share power, you lose power, right? The more you share, the less you have. But Moshe is also a Navi, and the Navi has influence. Influence is exactly the opposite of power. The more you share, the more you have. That's why one Rav can give smicha to many young students who will become Rabbanim. That doesn't limit his influence. It grows his influence. And perhaps there's something going on here and the Nar doesn't understand this, but nonetheless, Vayaratz HaNar, right? Vayan Yoshua. So Yoshua responds. Vayan Yoshua binun Mesharet Moshe mibachura vayom Adoni Moshe Klaim. Right? And so Yoshua says we should lock them up. It's interesting. There is no system of jail, of incarceration in Judaism. There are only a couple of instances in the entire Torah, at least the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, we find people being locked up. Every time you find someone being locked up, it's because we don't know what to do. The Mekoshei Sheitzim, the person who's gathering sticks, we don't know what to do. Which is, by the way, the penal system that we have today. You lock people up because you don't know what to do with them. Right? Judaism has a whole different system for how to rehabilitate people. But okay. So Yoshua says we should lock them up. Vayomer lo Moshe, so Moshe says to him, to Yoshua, HaMekane Atali, you worried about me, etc., etc. What's missing here? What's missing here? The Nar, and Rashi here, quotes the Medrash, Yesh Omrim Gershom ben Moshe Haya. Let's assume this was Gershom for the moment. Certainly, according to those who suggest this, the Gemara Bava Basra talks about this. So then this is Gershom. So Gershom comes running,
And he says, they're prophesying in the camp, there's a crisis. Yoshua responds, and then Moshe speaks to Yoshua. What's missing? Moshe doesn't talk to Gershom. That's mind-boggling. Your son comes running, and you have an opportunity to communicate with it. Now again, I'm saying this with great hesitation, talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. But we have to look at it as we see it and see if we can learn from it. So what's going on here? What is missing from this whole story? And how could this happen? The pasuk in Bamidbar in Perek Gimel, beginning of Perek Gimel of Bamidbar, Parashat Bamidbar, says Ve'ela Toldot Aaron and Moshe. These are the stories, really, the generations of Moshe, of Aaron and Moshe. Biyom Diber Hashem et Moshe b'Har Sinai. Ve'ela Shmot Bnei Aaron. So all the commentaries notice that it's talking about the generations of Moshe and Aaron, actually Aaron and Moshe, and then it lists the generations of Aaron. It doesn't list the generations of Moshe. So Rashi, right, Ve'no Maskir Ela Pnei Aaron, V'nikru Toldot Moshe, Lefi Shelamdan Torah, V'lamed Shekol HaMelamedet Ben Chavirot Torah, Male Alav HaKatuv Kilu Yelado. So Rashi points out, and the Mefarshim talk about this, that if you teach someone Torah, they become like your children, and that's beautiful. And we could have a whole discussion about this. But it's still missing something. So why isn't Moshe Rabbeinu teaching his children? That there's something wrong here. There's a fascinating discussion as to why it is that Moshe does not enter Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara, in responding to this question, says Moshe Rabbeinu was like the sun and Yeshua was like the moon. That's what it says. Now what's the difference between the sun and the moon? The generation of Moshe was the generation where Hashem was everywhere. In fact, Hashem was so there, there was no room for me. You see this sometimes in the children of very successful adults. Parents who are so there that there's no room for their kids. So what does a child do when the parent is so there that there's no room for him? He rebels. And that's exactly what happens in the desert. The Jewish people are constantly rebelling because they're basically saying, this is an oversimplification, here I am. Rav Kook talks about this in Sefer Oroth, here I am. So the Jewish people leave Moshe behind. They enter Eretz Yisrael without Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeshua is like the moon. Now you can't look at the sun. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from Har Sinai, Ki Karan Or Panav, he has to wear a veil because he's so there you almost can't look at him. He moves out of the camp. His oil has to be out of the camp. There's almost no relationship with him. Yeshua, on the other hand, Yeshua is the Nar. He's Mibachurav. He fights with the Jewish people. And it's interesting that when the Jewish people enter Eretz Yisrael, with the exception of one individual, Achan, there is no rebellion. All of Sefer Yeshua. Because they're too busy becoming. So one could make a suggestion now. Again, we're not indicting Chas V'Shalom Moshe Rabbeinu here. Sometimes a person gives things up because the Jewish people, right, Am Yisrael, is more important than Reb Yisrael. But it would seem that that is the price that Moshe Rabbeinu pays. And perhaps one can learn from this that the first rule of how to educate our children, how to inspire our children, how to make a difference in our children's lives, is that we have to be there. So I want to suggest four things. And if we had a few hours, we could get into this. I'm going to leave you with this to think about. The greatest gift that we give our children, it's not the best teachers. It's not the most valuable intellectual journey. It's not which school they get into, and it's not which college they get into. It's us. The greatest gift we give our children is ourselves. The biggest question that we have to ask. And I wonder how the fact that so many of our children are struggling with these questions is related to the fact that so many of us have become so busy. In fact, we're so busy that even when we're there, we're not always there. Sometimes you sit with a person, you know, we made a rule in the yeshiva. We try to live up to it. You can ask Mitch whether that works. You know, in our base marriage, we don't like cell phones, smartphones, etc. And certainly, you know, when you're talking to a student, so your cell phone goes in your pocket and goes off. Because sometimes you see people and they're having a conversation with you, but you're not really just talking to them. You're talking to them and their BlackBerry and their iPhone and their laptop and the secretary who comes to call, etc., etc. Can we really be there? By the way, I saw one of the topics here is how do we deal with the question of, you know, texting on Shabbos, half Shabbos, etc. That is the primary example of the conflict between the challenges of the society we live in today, at least the Western society we live in, and what Judaism wants of us. Shabbat is the ultimate day when we're meant to learn to be in the moment. Right? In fact, it's interesting. In Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, we say that a person, you know, when a person has to calm down, we say, Tia ragua. Be calm, ragua. Ragua is the same word as rega. Because being calm is about being in the moment. Right? I remember I learned this in the army. When I was in officer's course, so they did a very cool thing. Every week there was a test on all that we had studied the week before, right? Which included a lot of things that you learn out in the field. But before we would go out to Shetach again, and some of these tests were very difficult, you know, thermal imagery in the tank, laser technology, how the engine system works, et cetera, et cetera. And the guys, you know, we would, you know, get stuck on base for Shabbat, two out of three Shabbatot. And what guys would do is all Shabbos they would study. Right? And they'd be talking to each other in the room and asking each other difficult questions. So if there's blue smoke, is that gasoline, is that oil, is it? And I made a decision when I was in the army, whatever they were going to do, they were going to take away my Shabbos. So as a rule, I wouldn't study on Shabbat. So I would study up until Shabbat if I could, and Saturday night I'd be up till 3 in the morning, and it somehow worked out. And on the one hand, there was a certain stress because I knew they were all studying, and you would sometimes feel, so I would leave my room because I couldn't sit in there. But what it gave you was Shabbat. And you look back and you realize, you know, and I see this. You know, kids who have tests. So it started because kids have tests and, you know, they have a Gemara test on Sunday. Right? When I was a kid, my parents told me, if you have to study for a Gemara test on Shabbos, you're already in Sunday when you're on Shabbos. Figure out a way not to do it on Shabbat. Now, I'm not talking about halacha here. You could make a case for halacha to study for a Gemara test on Shabbos. You could probably make a case to study for a math test if your father's a mathematician. He loves it. I don't know. But you lose your Shabbat. You lose the ability to be in the moment. So the first rule is that we have to be there. We have to be in those moments. It can't be, you know, I was talking to my wife about this recently. Our youngest is, 2 minutes. Our youngest is in 10th grade. And so I realized, you know, he just finished 10th grade. And I said to my wife, you know, we have 2 more years of teachers meetings. We're almost done. And we were laughing about it. And then I caught myself, I was thinking about it. I'm actually gonna miss that to some degree. You know, the opportunity to really be involved in your child's education pro forma regularly. Is there a way to do that, even without being there? The second thing we learn from Moshe Rabbeinu is that the environment you're in is critical. You know? I personally, this is an easy thing to say. It's a more challenging thing to do. If for whatever the reason you choose to live in America, which I'll be honest with you, I don't fully get, but if you're living in America, at the very least, you should make it your business to visit Israel regularly. There's something about walking through the streets of Yerushalayim, standing on the hills of the Golan, that has an impact on our children. Right? And of course it's true also for the environment we create in the home and the environment we create in school. You know, I used to, at least once a week, I still do, go to Davin, you know, with one of my kids in the yeshiva. My son went to Shadmot. I would drive like an hour each way to spend at least once a month davening with him. And I started to notice that very few parents go and daven with their kids in their schools, which is a big mistake. Then you become part of that environment. The third is Chanoch L'Nar Al Pi Darko. You have to find what your children really love. Right? And you help them. You have to help them to love what they should love. And that's the part of the Yitro equation. And the last thing, right, which is maybe late in the game, just to finish this off, Rav Kook suggests that the first stage in effecting a change in our youth is that they first have to learn to respect Torah. Once a person learns to respect Torah, then maybe you're ready to share with them an environment. They don't have to love it. They don't have to agree next to Kiyum Mitzvot. But at least they should have respect for it. Once they respect for it, then maybe they're ready to start loving it. And once you teach them to love it, then they're ready to start experiencing it. We have to stop. I wish you tremendous success. I think this is wonderful that you're doing this. I hope you do this more often. And if anybody has any questions,
you can send your email.